BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
What makes something in me sing? Oh, I've gotta have my fling. Can't you see? Whoop, whoop. It's the animal in me.
The only time I remember being unequivocally delighted by seeing an animal appear on stage was in St. Petersburg in the early 90s, when my partner and I found ourselves watching an especially dreary production of Swan Lake. During Act Two, just as Prince Siegfried was being enchanted by the swan, a cat wandered on from the wings, tail held high. It was apparently completely unfazed by the fluttering tutus and swelling orchestral strings. It took its time, nonchalantly slaloming the sea of legs, pausing to sniff the curtain before crossing upstage left to exit. The cat was by a mile the best thing about that show. Comedy value aside, I loved its carelessness, transgression, power. No human was involved in the making of this entertainment. In this essay series, I'm not actually thinking about ballet. I'm taking a look at old-style variety shows. And here I'm thinking about acts involving non-human animals. I say non-human animals because, of course, we humans are animal too. But for the sake of better sentences, I'm going to just say animal from now on. I don't feel entirely good about that, as will become apparent, but I guess I'm in good company. Both the moral philosopher Mary Midgley and Peter Singer, author of the seminal Animal Liberation, have made the same apology in the past. Unscheduled appearances aside, domestic cats have sometimes turned up on variety stages, though not nearly as often as their wild relatives. Many animal acts that appeared in theatres came from the world of circus, and it was only during World War II that wild animals inside theatres were largely banned, not over concerns for their welfare, but in case of air raids, which might result in them breaking free and wreaking havoc. Post-war, the wild ones made something of a comeback. In 1954, Darlington Hippodrome hosted the Hip Hip Zuray Circus with elephants and the big cats. And during the 50s, Circus Rosaire filled the bill at the Queen's Theatre in Poplar, East London, with lions, bears and monkeys, alongside Joan Rosaire's famous Goldie the Wonder Horse, performing dogs, Bobby the Bear, and an invitation to come and stroke the lion cubs. Backstage must have been mayhem. By the time I was born, traditional variety theatre was all but dead, and both stricter legislation against cruelty and shifting public opinion was taking the more exotic animal acts out of UK's stage shows. A similar move with circus came a bit later, but by the 1960s, many theatres had closed or changed their programmes. And so most of my exposure to animal acts in theatre came through TV. I do, though, have two programmes for 1950s shows at the London Palladium and Finsbury Park Empire, both featuring Vogelbein's bears, Bruins at their best. At Finsbury Park Empire, they were followed by the intermission, during which the Empire Orchestra played a hit parade selection. I wonder if the Vogelbeins needed time to get the bicycle-riding bears safely backstage before Anne and Val Shelley opened the second half with Taps in Tempo. I wonder a lot of things. Vogelbein's brown bears were often photographed with collar, lead and muzzle. In one image, kissing, that's in inverted commas, Elizabeth Conyot, Vogelbein's wife. I never saw them, and I'm glad I didn't. I grew up with an unconditional love of all species of creature other than human, a sentiment shared by the rest of my family. And yes, I grew up with a menagerie, including various strays, and from the age of 10, a dog. We liked a lot of humans too, but certainly not all, and not on any terms. For me, other animals could do no wrong. When aged 8 I was quite badly bitten by a farm sheepdog, I only sobbed when I overheard the grown-ups talk of having him put down. When my friend and I accidentally rode our chopper bikes over an anthill, she said, "They're only ants and they bite." But I was racked with guilt and spent hours with a spoon and a bottle of lemonade from our picnic trying to re-sculpt their nest into shape. Sentimental, I guess. Anthropomorphic, probably. But I reckon there's a fine line between a kind of patronising determination to consider all other animals as versions of ourselves and a recognition of our interconnectedness. In her book Animals and Why They Matter, Mary Midgley writes of what she refers to as the species barrier, our inability to seriously consider other species as anything other than either chunks of walking meat or honorary, if somehow lesser, human beings. A sense of unreality often blocks our attempts to understand our moral relations with animals, she writes. Arguments for taking it seriously tend to be dismissed rather than met, to be stigmatised wholesale. They do not, however, go away. If anything, they become more pressing. Hear, hear, Mary. As a child, I didn't have the language for describing what I thought about animals being used for entertainment, but I knew my insides felt confused. The one time I was taken to a circus, the sight of elephants playing football made me cry with a sadness I couldn't articulate. And I was forever asking my parents to take me to the zoo, then half hating it when we got there. The thrill of seeing all those remarkable creatures alive, up close, versus anguish at their containment, loss of privacy, natural space. I guess I felt pretty much the same when I watched animals perform on stage. But what about dogs? In his book, A Cavalcade of Variety Acts, Roy Hudd says, "Personally, I always feel a bit uneasy when lions and tigers are shown, but I'm a lot happier when dogs or chimps are on. I've never seen a dog act where the stars weren't constantly wagging their tails, or a chimp act where it seemed the monkeys weren't having a ball." All right, Roy, I'll give you the dogs, although I've something to say about chimpanzees in a minute. Dogs have always been one of the most popular species appearing in light entertainment, and it's easy to see why. Usually highly trainable, though our basset hound was impossible, naturally playful, eager to please, the old playbills are littered with them. Darcy's dogs, Anna and her pals, David Rosaire and his perky peaks, and Billy Brown and his upside-down dog, sharing a bill in 1938 with my Uncle Gordon at the new Hippodrome, Darlington. As a version of variety has kind of morphed into TV shows like Britain's Got Talent, dogs are still everywhere. That show was even won in 2015 by the dog Matisse and its owner Jules O'Dwyer, and in 2012 by Ashley Umpudsey, who went on to appear at the 84th Royal Variety Performance. So what about those chimps? Roy Hudd isn't alone in believing that they're having a ball. And of course, of all species, aren't they the ones who are most like us? The great primatologist and anthropologist Jane Goodall, who's devoted her life to the study of chimps in the wild, is often credited with doing more than anyone to challenge a common belief in what's been described as human exceptionalism. The idea that we humans are totally different from and superior to animals. But as a headline from her institute reads, "Unlike humans, no chimp ever dreams of going into showbiz." And she's frequently argued that portraying apes as human caricatures is not only insulting to their dignity, but conveys the inaccurate message that they enjoy performing unnatural tricks and looking daft for our amusement. She also argues this leads the public to forget both that these animals are critically endangered and that in the wild they stay with their mothers until they're around 8 years old. Apes in entertainment have frequently been taken from their families as infants when they're easier to dominate and handle, with disastrous consequences for their development, to say nothing of the impact on the mothers of having their young forcibly removed. In our ill-informed public imagination, chimps have perhaps always existed somewhere between the wild and domestic. And although in the UK these days we're much more likely to watch them on TV in their natural habitat, narrated by David Attenborough, I grew up seeing them wearing clothes, smoking cigarettes, riding motorbikes, and in the 1971 PG Tips advert, shifting a piano upstairs. The original advert for Brooke Bonte featured the Marquis chimps, trained by Jean Detroit, born Samuel Wood in Stockport in 1909. After working as a tightrope walker with his family of circus and musical performers, he'd bought a chimp for £300 and trained him to become the centre of his act. The Marcus chimps were going strong on stage, well into the 1980s. Animals traditionally regarded as less exciting than chimps are also given due respect and attention in many nature documentaries these days, but they were often used in variety to give a wow or oh factor to an otherwise run-of-the-mill act. Hence Jack Codell using budgerigars in his magic routine and involving a disappearing parakeet in the Indian rope trick. The bird acts are endless. And then there's the horses, an educated pig, would you believe, and of course the rabbits, who are to this day occasionally pulled from top hats. As late as 2014, national daily papers reported that magician Paul Daniels had needed hospital treatment after being bitten by one of his magic act rabbits. I confess I did not weep for him. But why are we so fascinated by watching animals? Is it an evolutionary thing? After all, our survival has always depended on our relationship with them. Or is it narcissistic to see ourselves reflected, albeit a little more distorted than in a mirror? Or that their natural vitality and ability to be utterly themselves somehow comforts and reassures us? Or even that we see them as metaphor, carriers of an emotion? As the poet Emily Dickinson wrote, "Hope is the thing with feathers." When I watch animals, I'm always moved by a sense of the close connection between us and them, but equally by their otherness, the existential barrier that must always exist and make other species not entirely knowable. Returning for a moment to that cat wandering on stage during Swan Lake, alongside the mystery of why it had chosen to appear, one of the things I most loved was its freedom. That this experience was not so far removed from seeing an animal in its natural habitat. And I loved how it disrupted the narrative of an official event. Animal as anarchist. What were we now looking at? A ballet or a cat? And that cat, its apparent complete disregard of the audience. What did it see? Or didn't it look or care? For an audience, animal acts are predominantly about looking. And whilst much has been written about the politics of the male gaze, and more recently the female gaze, much less about the human gaze at other species. What were we seeing in those variety shows as we sat in the auditorium or on our settees? What were we hoping to see? What were we laughing at or applauding, the trainer or the trained? And did we ever consider what the animals were seeing? In his 1977 essay, Why Look at Animals, John Berger writes, "The fact that they can observe us has lost all significance. They are the objects of our ever-extending knowledge. What we know about them is an index of our power, and thus an index of what separates us from them." We stare at animals on a stage, awestruck, amused, appalled, fascinated, entertained. They rarely, if ever, stare back. And I wonder how we would feel if they did.